listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, as feared, Harry Reid wimped out. This, you know, if we had President Rubio and Speaker Boehner and Majority Leader McConnell, they would get rid of the filibuster just like that, just like Republicans were threatening to do back during the brief period of time during the Bush administration when they had nearly that level of control, and as they've muttered about doing in previous Republican administrations. But Harry Reid somehow thinks that if he keeps Democrats' hands tied behind their back for the next 4 years or the next 2 years, actually the next 2 years, in fact, all of these so-called reforms that he's promoting are going to evaporate in 2 years, that the Republicans will say, oh, well, you know, you did really good on that, so we'll keep our hands tied behind our back, too. All the filibuster does is empower crazies to run on crazy positions, extremists to run on extreme positions, because they don't have to legislate them, right? They don't have to, you know, there's no 50 vote thing. In other words, they can stop things, but they can't actually do things. So it's a sad day. What can I say? All right. That said, there's also a very interesting story. Welcome to America, where you have to go to jail to get the health care you need. Stephen Espelin, 57 years old, told a judge last week that he really didn't want to kill President Obama or his family like he told the Secret Service earlier. That he really did this, he threatened the president in order to get arrested, and in fact, he's just been sentenced to 4 years in prison for threatening the life of the president. He said that he did this, I mean, he's come out now after he was sentenced. He was willing to talk about it, but he wanted to make sure he got his four-year sentence. He did it because he didn't have health care. He went to a hospital, he checked in under a phony name saying that he had insurance. He had cancer and heart disease. When they discovered that he had used a phony name and didn't have insurance, they literally kicked him out of the hospital. So now that he's in jail, he's getting the chemotherapy he needs. Apparently, it's a fairly mild cancer. It'll be knocked out. And then he is scheduled, once he starts his prison term in a few months, to get heart surgery. Same thing with James Richard Verone in North Carolina. Back in 2011, he walked into a bank, told the teller he was robbing them of $1, took the dollar, walked over and sat down on a bench, waiting for the cops to come and get him. He'd been a delivery driver for Coca-Cola for 17 years. He got laid off, and he had a protrusion on his chest as well as arthritis and carpal tunnel syndrome, so he couldn't work, which meant he couldn't get a job, which meant he couldn't get health insurance. And so for him, again, the only way to get health insurance was to go to jail. Or Ron Paul. You know, this is the great champion of libertarian. Kent Snyder was his campaign manager in 2008. Kent Snyder raised millions of dollars for him. However, Ron Paul does not pay health insurance for his campaign staffers. He figures, hey, let them stand on their own two damn feet, right? And so Kent Snyder ran up. He had a pretty bad infection in his chest, and he kept ignoring it and ignoring it and ignoring it, and finally went to the hospital, and it was too late. He died of pneumonia and left a $400,000 bill to his family, which the Ron Paul campaign said ain't ours. So what are we going to do in the United States? Peter Suderman is with us. He's a senior editor and columnist at The Reason magazine, reason.com. And Peter, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Back.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for joining, for coming back on. What possible reason would libertarians have for saying that we should not have a national health care program, given the kind of stories that I just shared?
Well, I think there's two things that I would say here. One is, if you're going to talk about a national health care program, you have to define what you actually mean by that. We have a number of national health care programs right now. We have Obamacare, which is about to kick in. We have Medicare. We have Medicaid. And so that brings
us to the VA.
We also have the VA.
VA is socialized medicine. Medicare and Medicaid are single-payer medicine. Obamacare is a hybrid system that's part private, part public.
Well, Medicaid actually relies an awful lot on private contractors and private insurers, and Medicare has some sections that are run through private insurers as well.
No, but they're both fully paid for by the government.
They are.
So they're single payer programs.
Yes, by the federal government, in Medicare's case.
You said I have to define this. Let me lay down a simple definition for you. There are some things that are just too big for all of us to deal with, and healthcare is one of them. I mean, this is crazy that we're spending twice as much as any other country in the world, and we have a shorter lifespan than the average lower middle class Frenchman.
So here's the question I would ask is the problem that we don't have programs, or is the problem that we have programs that aren't working very well and that are poorly designed?
The problem is that people like you, advancing this libertarian theology, and it's just clearly a theology. I mean, it's a belief system without facts. People like you have been promoting this theology all these years, and they prevented Richard Nixon from doing it. They prevented Barack Obama from having any kind of, we're the only one, the only nation in the developed world that doesn't consider health care a right instead of a privilege. You have a right to a lawyer. If you get arrested, the government will provide you a lawyer for free. Why don't you have a right to health care?
So in the case of the first individual that you mentioned, he's from Florida. Florida spends $18 billion a year on Medicaid. That's out of, like I said, $400
billion. He does not have a right to health care in Florida.
Are we not spending enough money?
He does not have a right to health care in Florida or in any other state in the union.
People in Medicaid in Florida, that is a huge program.
He does not have a right to health care in Florida.
Programs for the people who are
Peter, why do you think that health care should not be a right? What part of the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is incomprehensible to you?
Well, clearly we already have tens of millions of people who have health care benefits given to them through the government. Medicaid covers 60 million people in the United States.
Then if we've gone that far and you agree with that, why don't you just say, okay, we have a right to health care, now let's do it in the most efficient way possible.
I would like to see a much more efficient system. Now, we would probably disagree on what the efficiencies that could be.
But wait a minute. Will you acknowledge that we have a right to health care?
Terribly inefficient system as it stands that is not.
Are you going to acknowledge that we have a right to health care or not?
We do not have one built into our legal system currently.
Okay, so you are of the opinion that
$1 trillion or so worth of health care programs that aren't working very well.
So you're of the opinion that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, our founding document, I realize it's not part of our laws, but it's our founding document, that the right to life that is defined in the Declaration of Independence does not include the right to keep your life. If you get sick and you can't afford to pay for health care, sorry, you're dead. You got no right to life.
So, again, these are, complicated semantics.
There's nothing complicated about that. You either have a right to life or you don't have a right to life.
Life is a right. I mean, again, this is basic philosophy rather than actually discussing the program.
No, it's saying every person in America has the right to access the access health care system that will keep them alive or not.
How can we spend it better? But if you want to talk about this, then the question you ask is a right to life a right to require someone else to do something for you?
Do we have a right to life?
Do we have a right to require someone else to do something for us?
Peter, to the best of my knowledge, no doctor in any hospital, no nurse in any hospital, one of my daughters is one of them, is required to show up for work. Do you know of any who are? I mean, even in our jails, we don't take doctors who have been convicted of murder and say, okay, now you're the doctor in the jail because you're required to be in the jail.
That's certainly the case that they are no more required to show up for work than anyone who is employed.
Okay. We've hit the clock. Peter Sunderman, you can read all about it at Reason.com. Thank you, Peter.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, do we have the right to a filibuster if we don't have the right to life? Apparently, we do. The Republicans do, anyway. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television by the Free Speech TV Network on Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems nationwide. More people watch or listen to the Tom Hartman program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. Welcome back. Bob Edgar is on the line with us, the president and CEO of Common Cause. And, hey, Bob, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. We have been on this program campaigning very vigorously, shall we say, for some weeks for Jeff Merkley's amendment. Jeff Merkley's been on the program several times. Jeff Merkley, Tom Udall, Elizabeth Warren has been on the program, mentioned it. And it looks like Harry Reid just laid down on the tank, roll over him.
Harry Reid cut the legs out of all of the progressives who wanted filibuster reform. I hope that Senator Harkin and Senator Merkley and a number of the newer senators who really want to reform Senate rules will really take a hard look at this. I think the Senate needs leadership. It needs reform. And I'm hoping that some of those senators will join our federal lawsuit, because we believe that the filibuster is actually unconstitutional. The founding fathers were pretty smart. They put seven instances in the Constitution for a supermajority, but they were scared to death that democracy would evolve into a supermajority vote on every issue. And if we're going to have to see this moving forward, my friend Congressman Tom Harkin says that the White House isn't going to get any of their priorities if they have to live under the filibuster rules that Harry Reid has succumbed to. I think he's really capitulated to the Republicans in many respects. And, you know, as soon as we get to a hard issue like the gun issue or the fiscal cliff issues, you're going to see filibuster after filibuster, just as we saw in the past. And you're going to see, you know, one senator sending an email or making a telephone call, threatening a filibuster and stopping progress. I think I mentioned on your television show a couple weeks ago that most everybody likes Medicare. It only passed by 55 votes in 1965. So good things get dumped if you have to have more than a majority vote. So this is not a good day for the Senate. It's not a good day for reformers. It's not a good day for fixing the rules in the Senate. But it is a good day to kind of bind together and pick up the pieces and go forward. And I hope our lawsuit, which is now the only game in town for fixing the filibuster, proceeds.
And that's at commoncause.org. People can learn more about that.
Yeah, just go to commoncause.org and you can find a lot of information, including the lawsuit that we filed. That's probably one of the best historical documents on the history of the filibuster.
What do you say to people like some of the Senate staffers, I'm assuming associated with Senator Reid, although they're quoted in various media as just, you know, Democratic Senate staffers, who say things like, well, you know, if the filibuster wasn't there, the Republicans would have already privatized Social Security. They would have already overturned Roe v. Wade. There, you know, a lot of progressive things never would have happened. Quack, quack, quack.
That's horse baloney. Filibuster was used more often, to protect lynching laws and segregation than it was human rights, civil rights, or any of the good stuff. And, you know, while the Democrats have occasionally been in the minority, when they are in the minority, it's been hard for them to hold together and really use the filibuster as abusively as the conservative Republicans have been using the filibuster. This filibuster ought not to be a tool for obstruction. The Senate should be a place where full debate takes place. And up until this very day, the filibuster is used to block debate, to block deliberation, rather than to extend debate and open the opportunity. Why shouldn't senators go on the floor with legislation, debate it fully, have the minority and the majority, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, offer amendments, change those amendments, and then have a final passage by majority rule, go over with the House into conference committees? When I served in Congress, my best friends were Republicans, and those Republicans back in those days, working with the Democrats, would fight very hard for their positions. They'd pass a bill in the House, they'd pass a bill in the Senate, and then they'd go to conference committees and negotiate out an energy bill or resource recovery legislation or the Older Americans Act or Head Start. since the filibuster has been used as a political tool by the Republicans, those discussions, debates, and collaborations and compromise simply don't take place.
Yeah. And to those who suggest that, well, if you think this is bad now, just wait until the Republicans run the Senate. You're really going to be happy that we kept the filibuster. My prediction is the first thing the Republicans will do if they have the House, the Senate, and the White House, if we have President Rubio and Majority Leader McConnell, that you're going to, the first thing they're going to do is change the filibuster.
Absolutely. If Romney had won the election and the Republicans had taken over the Senate, they'd be all over changing the rules of the Senate. This is simply an ultra-conservative, radical way to block all public policy.
So why'd Harry Reid cave in?
Well, remember, a couple weeks ago, Harry Reid did an interview. He's going to cave on assault weapons. He's going to cave on bullet clips. He comes from a fairly conservative region of the country. He's been a conservative most of his Senate career. And I think he's been vaccinated by the Bobby Byrd thought that you don't change the rules of the Senate except every 100 years. And it's just unacceptable.
The institution above all else. Bob Edgar, the president and CEO of Common Cause. Check it out, commoncause.org. Get informed about their lawsuit and help them make it work. Bob, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great talking. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'll give you the details of this so-called filibuster reform. Reid is actually claiming that he has reformed the filibuster, and there are a few tweaks here and there. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman. Senator Ron Johnson, R-Woodshed, as Shano says, is the joke circulating right now. He's actually the Republican from Wisconsin. I believe he's the guy, I'm not actually certain, so I'll just leave it at that. Anyhow, he got slapped down yesterday by Hillary Clinton when he was... This is just political grandstanding, right? There's these weird conspiracy theories going around. Absolutely weird conspiracies. There's one that Rand Paul was promoting last night on Fox News. In fact, I was on another network last night. I was walking into the building and Rand Paul walked by me and I'm like, whoa. First time I'd actually seen him up close. My first thought was, who is that really short guy? And he's like his dad. He's just a very, very little guy. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, it struck me. It's funny how TV changes the aspect ratio of people. But in any case, Rand Paul was promoting the conspiracy theory that we are trying to disarm Libya as like the practice run for disarming. This is the UN, the United States, the one world government folks. This is kind of the Alex Jones version. Well, I shouldn't attribute this to Alex Jones. I don't know if he said this. This is the conspiracy theory version of this, is that we are disarming Libya to see what it's like to disarm a nation that is well-armed, because the United States is so well-armed. There's 300 million guns out there in the United States. Libya was really well-armed, and so we're disarming Libya so as a test. And if we can pull this off and what we can learn from it, we can use to then disarm America. And so, Ron, and we're taking those arms that we're getting from Libya, and hey, they got value, and Turkey is an ally of ours, and so let's just sell it to Turkey for their military to use. In fact, here's a clip from last night with Ron Paul with his crazy theory that literally, I mean, he's attributing this to the internet, right? I mean, you can read this on some of the real whack job internet sites, but that's about it. Here he is.
I think arms were being sold and have been sold out of Libya to Turkey, and they're winding up in the hands of the Syrian rebels. I think they did not want to draw attention to that. That may have been occurring through the CIA annex. I don't have proof of this. No one's given me any information. I have no briefing to this.
It doesn't exist, but I'm going to put it out there anyway. Yeah, that was Rand Paul last night on Hannity. And Ron Johnson, you know, pursuing a similar crazed conspiracy theory, that being that somehow it would help Democrats in the election if we thought that the people who killed the ambassador and his aide and the two security guards in Benghazi in Libya, if we thought that the people who killed them were protesters rather than terrorists. And I guess the meme here is that even though, I mean, there have been attacks on our embassies literally every year for decades. And some of the most horrific and bloody ones certainly have happened on Republican administrations. But nobody, to the best of my knowledge, has ever really politicized these. I mean, the Democrats didn't even politicize 9/11, which was arguably the biggest attack of all and the biggest intelligence failure of all, or at least the biggest failure to act on intelligence by an administration. But somehow Ron Johnson and his Republican buddies think that the Obama administration concluded, Hillary Clinton had figured out that if the American people knew that some terrorists had killed one of our guys, that they would think that Obama was soft on terror or something and wouldn't like Obama and wouldn't reelect him. The Democratic electorate would desert him. So Ron Johnson goes after Hillary Clinton yesterday, and she basically kicks it back in his teeth. Here's that.
No. We were misled that there was supposedly protests, and then something sprang out of that, an assault sprang out of that. And that was easily ascertained that was not the fact.
But
and the American people could have known that within days, and they didn't know that.
With all due respect, the fact is we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again, Senator.
Bang. Now that, I mean, she was quite passionate about that, and she had been hectored for hours, and this is just an absurd theory. And so now the New York Post has this picture of Hillary Clinton being quite passionate. I mean, you know, holding her hands as fists and you know, speaking to the table. And it says, no wonder Bill's afraid. Hillary explodes with rage at Benghazi hearing. All over the right wing netosphere and nutosphere, you will find all of these characterizations of Hillary as emotional and hysterical and, you know, all these words that are always applied to women as pejoratives. But back to Ron Johnson. So then today, and this is why Shana was calling him the R-Woodshed Senator, the Republican from the Woodshed. He got schooled by Hillary yesterday. Today it was John Kerry's turn. And so he tries his same nutter butter theory on John Kerry. Benghazi, you guys were covering stuff up and you didn't tell us and we didn't know and, you know, quack, quack, quack. And you can see the video over at TPM. Here is, just a little bit of that interaction. And there's just this very precious moment where he says, why don't we know this stuff, Senator? Senator Johnson is asking Senator Kerry, who is going to be the Secretary of the State. And John Kerry says, those of us who showed up at the hearing do know it. I mean, we watched the tapes. We watched the raid on Benghazi in real time, which is probably something that shouldn't have been said out loud in public. But, you know, basically Ron Johnson forced it. So just listen to this. This is so, so ironic.
And that some things, may or may not be ripe to take place.
John Kerry.
In the not too distant future.
Okay. Will you work with me then on an ongoing basis,
Ron Johnson,
so we can get that behind us, so we can find out what actually happened, and then we can move beyond that? I mean, can you just make that commitment to me?
Well, I think, Senator, in all fairness, I think we do know what happened. I think that it is very clear. Were you at the briefing with the tapes?
No.
Well,
oops.
There was a briefing with tapes, which we all saw, those of us who went to it.
Bang.
Which made it crystal clear. We sat for several hours with our intel folks who described to us precisely what we were seeing.
Whap.
We saw all of the events unfold. We
Pow.
Had a very complete and detailed description.
Piff. Yes, but we know what happened.
Yes, and That was Senator Johnson's response. Elmer Fudd. It's really quite remarkable. Oh, my. So, Nick in Lyndhurst, New Jersey. Hey, Nick, you're...
Hey, Tom.
You have some...
talking about the filibuster situation.
Yeah.
This is not about Harry Reid being ignorant or stupid or weak or afraid.
I'm not suggesting he's any of those adjectives.
No. What I think is happening, he's fully aware of all the dynamics that you and I and the listeners are aware of. We know what's going on. It's painfully clear that Reid and the establishment of the Democratic Party are afraid of ever actually having the power to actually pass progressive legislation, which they pay.
I don't agree with that at all, Nick. I absolutely disagree because when Nancy Pelosi ran the House of Representatives, she actually passed progressive legislation. Yes, it went to die in the Senate, and they should have stood up for it. But this is why the Senate rules should be passed. But I don't think these guys are afraid. I do think that there's a fairly high probability that one of the reasons why Senator Reid did what he did was because he didn't have all of his caucus with him. He didn't have the 51 votes he needed to actually make the change. That there was a half a dozen senators, and Jeff Merkley named them in a phone call with a progressive activist, which has really PO'd Senator Reid. Senator Merkley is in the woodshed right now. I think that's what we should be talking about. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl, what's up?
You know, the only thing I have to say about that is now they don't have a leg to stand on. They can shut up and no more complaining about Republican obstructionists and filibustering, because you had a chance to do something and you didn't do it again, Harry Reid. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Carl. I don't know how to respond to that other than to say, yeah, it's a problem. It is a problem. Dennis in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Dennis.
Hi, Tom. I would like to know how Harry Reid ever got into that position in the first place and why he can't be replaced.
Harry Reid was elected to that position by his peers. Harry Reid's a very good and smart legislator, and he's done a lot of good stuff in his career. I mean, let's not paint the guy with one brush for one vote or one whatever, one wimp out. Although, you know, I think that we've been seeing a series of them for quite some time. But I think he's a decent man. I think that the Democratic Party right now, the influence of money in politics is so great that you've got a bunch of states where you've got Democrats who are senators and Democrats who are members of the House of Representatives, for that matter, where they know that in their states, if they cross certain lines, like voting on gun control, for example, that, you know, the money is going to come down on them like an absolute screaming ton of bricks, and they're never going to see daylight again. And it's one of the reasons why we need to be reforming our entire political system from the top down. But here I am defending Harry Reid. I didn't mean to do that. We'll be back 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So is Rand Paul right? Are they using Libya as a test case to find out how to disarm a populace so they can disarm us next? It's Talk Media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. And Rob in how do you say the name of that city in Ohio? Pataskala?
Pataskala.
Okay. So, Rob, you agree with Rand Paul that we're using Libya as a test case to figure out how to disarm an armed populace?
No, the question that was apparently thrown back in his face about the video or protest, I forget who asked. Was that Rand Paul that asked that?
No, that was Ron Johnson.
Oh, Ron Johnson.
Rand Paul was asking Hillary Clinton yesterday about whether or not weapons taken away from Libyans are being sold to Turkey. And Hillary Clinton basically said, I don't know. Ask the CIA.
All right. I want to talk about the question that apparently she threw back in that gentleman's face.
Oh, Ron Johnson, the guy who didn't bother to show up for the intelligence hearings. Right, okay.
Yeah. So. You know, it amazes me that they came out, what was it, a week or two later and said it was because of a video, even though they knew
it was a terrorist attack within a day or two or even hours, because they had video, live video feed why it was happening.
Well, they had live video feed from 30,000 feet or probably 130,000 feet.
And, you know,
I don't know that you can tell somebody's intent.
Do. I've never seen a protester bring a, you know.
So you're of the opinion, Rob, that the administration intentionally lied to us about who killed these guys in Benghazi. Why would the administration do that?
Because they were, it was an election.
And what possible advantage could the Obama administration get from our ambassador being killed by protesters as opposed to being killed by actual bad guy terrorists? Seems to me like if they had come right out and said, hey, some bad guy terrorists killed the ambassador, you know, they would actually be, that would be a political star for them rather than, hey, you know, some protesters.
It was an advantage. It was an advantage to keep it under wraps until after the election was over.
How?
Because even while the election was going on, they
no. How is it an advantage?
It was because of a video.
How is it an advantage?
Most American.
How is it an advantage?
All right, then. Do we have embassies in like France or whatever, where we have, you know, a bunch of military there, you know, guarding people with, you know, where they really don't need them, but we have an ambassador that's begging for reinforcements. He let them know that there are terrorists around, and it was ignored.
Rob, a couple of things here. First of all, do you understand that Benghazi was not an embassy; it was a consulate?
Hand down.
Bob, are you? Can you hear me, Rob?
Yeah, I hear you. Perfectly.
Do you understand that in Benghazi was a consulate and not an embassy?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's no comparison with an embassy in France. Secondly,
why are we not protecting?
Do you get it that the House Republicans for 6 years in a row now, or for 4 years, have had a hold on appropriation money for the State Department for security? They have been cutting back. I thought that was the high point of the hearings yesterday. I'm astounded that it didn't get more press when Hillary Clinton pointed out that one of the reasons why security, the State Department security, is not as good as she would like is that they have been asking for money and the Republicans have filibustered it in the Senate or blocked it in the House of Representatives for six years now.
Where's all the money going?
The Republicans are refusing to spend it.
I mean, we spent over $1 trillion
Rob, the Republicans are refusing to give the State Department the money. They'll give it to the Army. They'll give it to the military. The Pentagon can have all the money it wants. They'll give it to the CIA. They can have all the money they want. But they won't give it to the State Department because the State Department is part of this administration. It's a Democratic administration. So they're trying to screw the Democratic administration however they can.
They're trying to screw the Democratic administration?
Of course they are. Of course they are.
Okay. I honestly don't believe that at all.
Well, Ron, you ought to call your Republican member of the House of Representatives and ask them why they will not allow more funding for security for the department. Why is everybody talking over me?
I'm sorry. I apologize. I don't mean to.
I'm wondering if there's something wrong with our equipment. Could you hear me, Rob?
Yeah, I can hear you.
You could hear me and you just kept on talking? I mean, that's okay if that's what you want to do.
Please continue.
Pardon?
Please continue.
Okay. Well, you know, why don't you call your Republican representative and ask them why they have blocked increased funding for security for State Department for embassies around the United States for the last 6 years? Or the last 4 years, excuse me.
I couldn't answer that.
That's why I'm saying call your Republican member of Congress and ask them, and then call me back and tell me what they say, because I'm hearing.
Apparently, don't you know the answer to that?
Okay. Rob, I don't think our conversation is going anywhere here. David in Seattle. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, it's pretty thick debating sometimes, and I get frustrated myself with that type of talking over stuff. So I was calling today about my frustration with Harry Reid. I tried to call his office, and his staff doesn't even have an answer. And I think it's regarding gun control. I think it's regarding passing a gun control bill with 51% and the political results of that for them. And it's very discouraging after listening to Obama's speech and after watching Virginia gerrymander as one of their Democratic representatives. Is, you know, they're taking away progressive stations. They're doing all this gerrymandering. And like we're running around with five.
Here's a conspiracy theory as to what as to what Harry Reid did that actually makes a certain amount of sense to me. And that is that there are Democratic senators who want to be able to say, I voted for gun control, but don't want to take the heat for gun control passing in their states. And I'm guessing this is basically what you're saying, is that if Harry Reid can get 51 votes for gun control, he can say to the gun control people, hey, we tried, but we couldn't get 60 votes to overcome a Republican filibuster. And the Democrats who live in those swing states where gun control might bite them in the butt, they can say, you know, we didn't really pass any gun control, so don't blame me.
Right. And I'm trying to figure all this out because, I mean, Harry Reid said during the campaign that was his priority. And he said he was going to fight for us.
This is like Machiavellian politics. I mean, it's like layers of deception within each other. But, David, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening in Seattle. We'll see where this all goes. Coming up next, the co-host of Liberty, of Sons of Liberty Radio, an ordained preacher and heavy metal drummer, is going to be with us to talk about atheists and God.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Thomas Jefferson, who in 1814, in a letter to Dr. Thomas Cooper, said, finally, in answer to Fortescue Allen's question why the Ten Commandments should not now be a part of the common law of England, we may say they are not because they never were. He said that, in truth, the alliance between church and state in England has ever made their judges accomplices in the frauds of the clergy, and even bolder than they are. But I think perhaps most importantly, you go to the Jefferson Memorial here in Washington, D.C., and it, you know, there's this dome in the top, and the words that are carved inside that circle are, I have sworn upon the altar of God. One of the few times that Jefferson publicly referenced God, eternal hostility against every form of tyranny imposed upon the mind of man. And people think, oh, he must have been a godly guy. Here's the letter that it came from. Just to put this in context. This is in 1800. It was to Ben Rush. This was 2 months before he was elected president of the United States. He was fighting a furious campaign for president with the then president. And he says, dear Sir, Benjamin Rush here is the guy he's writing to. And in this letter, he says, dear Sir, I promised you a letter on Christianity. And I have not forgotten. I do not know that it would reconcile. Here it is right here. I do not know that it would reconcile the genus irritable vatum, which is Latin for the angry priests, who are all in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting a ground to be softened. The delusion on the clause of the Constitution, which while it secured the freedom of the press, he's talking about the First Amendment, covered also the freedom of religion, has given to the clergy a very favorite hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States. And as every sect believes its own form, the true one, everyone perhaps hoped for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and Congregationalists. The returning, and here's the sentence, the returning good sense of our country, which he's talking about himself being elected president of the United States. The returning, because here, you know, John Adams was, he was running against John Adams, and Adams was pretty openly Christian. The returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes, and the preachers believe that any portion of power confided to me, such as being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly, for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me. But it is enough, too, in their opinion. So Jefferson was worrying about the tyranny of the religious. Let's get Bradley Dean's thoughts on this. He's the co-host of the Sons of Liberty Radio, an ordained preacher and heavy metal drummer for the band Junkyard Prophet. SonsOfLibertyRadio.com is the website. Bradley, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Now, Jefferson, I have a copy, actually. Jefferson famously went through the New Testament, cut out all the miracles, and published it as the, you know, basically saying Jesus was a philosopher. He was not a a god. And this book is being passed out, I guess, by atheists here in Washington, D.C., and this has you upset?
No, it doesn't have me upset. I mean, it's not like the, for the most part, when you look at the politicians, it's you speak to them as if they even know the Constitution or the foundations or the history of where we have come from and where we're going. And it's interesting that I've been listening to you for the last 5 minutes, and I hear animosity towards our foundations. And I hear it over and over and over again. And I'm just humored when we look around at all of the historical documentation that we have. And to deny the very existence of where law came from, laws of nature and nature's God. Mm-hmm. We derive our rights were endowed unto us by our Creator.
Well, here, let me share with you this very, very quickly. In a letter to Thomas Cooper, February 10th, 1814, so you can easily Google it, this is Thomas Jefferson. Sir Matthew Hale lays it down in these words, Christianity is parcel of the laws of England. But Christianity had not been introduced till the 7th century, the conversion of the first Christian king of the Heptarchy having taken place in the year 598 and that of the last about 686. Here then was a space of 200 years during which the common law was in existence and Christianity no part of it. We might as well say that the Newtonian system of philosophy is part of the common law as that the Christian religion is. It was not, and he goes on, I mean, he's... Here's another one. He says, our revolution commenced on more favor. Well, that's about the modern revolution. But, yeah, I mean, Jefferson said, in fact, he ended that letter. He ended a letter to 1824, a letter to Cartwright. He said, what a conspiracy this between church and state. Sing terra tara, rogues all, rogues all. No, Jefferson was of the opinion that Christianity had nothing to do with common law.
Really?
Well, he wrote several letters saying so.
Thomas Jefferson was also the president of the United States.
Yeah, for 8 years.
As was he the president of public schools in Washington, D.C., and the two books that were made mandatory were the Bible and Watts hymnals.
Thomas Jefferson was
Anglican under the influence of English deists. When we look at the history of who we are, if I can invoke or incite Charles...
Where Carroll, are you getting this stuff?
The Declaration of Independence. He's the one
where are you getting this stuff?
Well, let me respond to your question to your brother from another mother. Without morals, a republic cannot subsist any length of time. They, therefore, who are decrying the Christian religion, whose morality is so sublime and pure and which ensures to the good eternal happiness, are undermining the solid foundation of morals, the best security of the duration of free government. That was a signer of the Declaration of Independence.
It was not Thomas Jefferson.
The 55 signers.
That was not Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, on February 1st, 1799, in his diary, wrote, when the clergy addressed General Washington on his departure from the government, it was observed in their consultation that he had never on any occasion said a word to the public which showed a belief in the Christian religion.
On your show, can I respond?
And, well, let me just finish this, just a sentence or two here. And that George Washington had never on any occasion said a word to the public which showed a belief in the Christian religion, and they thought he should do so. However, Jefferson wrote, the old fox was too cunning for them. He answered every article of their address, particularly except that which he passed over without notice. And then he says, I know that Governor Morris, who pretends to be in his secrets in Washington confidence and believed him to be so, has often told me that General Washington believes no more in that Christian system than he himself did.
You might want to go to his home and look on his casket, because he's got scripture on his casket, might I add.
But
again,
there.
If we can go back, he's also the guy that said religion and morality are the essential pillars of civil society. Now, if I can have a minute to answer some of your questions, I'd be more than happy to do
that.
You
have 1 minute.
He said, where are you coming up with these things? Well, the Washington Monument, at the very top of the Washington Monument, it says, praise be to God. On the stairs inscribed all the way to the very top is scripture. when you go to the Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C., you see Moses and the Ten Commandments, and right under it, it says, Justice, the Guardian of Liberty. Now, when you go inside the chambers, you see In God We Trust. When you go to Arlington Cemetery, you see Christian crosses over the top of the heads of our boys that ratified the Constitution of the United States to give us liberty and the freedoms that we now have. If you go to the Liberty Bell, my friend, you see Leviticus 25:10 on it. It says, proclaim liberty.
So which of the Christian religions should we make the official religion of America, Dave?
The flags that were flying during the Revolutionary War time.
Bradley, which of the Christian religions should be our official religion, then?
I'm trying to figure out, where are you getting your information from?
From Thomas Jefferson's diary and letters.
Allegiance. I can go on and on and on and on. I could transport you to the sun, and you wouldn't see the sun.
Maybe. I'll leave you with the last word. Bradley Dean, sonsoflibertyradio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back right after this, 15 minutes past the hour, and the old fox was too cunning for them, Jefferson wrote of George Washington. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. You know, we didn't get filibuster reform, but life goes on. Let's move ahead. One of the things that it's going to be very interesting to watch is how Senator Reid and the Democrats react when there are efforts made to filibuster things. There were some, you know, kind of around the edges, some changes made in the filibuster, in the nature of the filibuster, but I think that the ability to call out the Republicans for obstruction is something that hasn't been used anywhere near enough by the Democrats to point out, you know, what's going on. Chris in Vallejo, however you say it, California. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Tom, it's Vallejo, yeah, about 30 miles north of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. You know, I just wanted to piggyback on the filibuster, but I don't know what anybody knows, that two of the people who were hoping to get rid of the speaking filibuster reform were Dianne Feinstein and Senator Boxer. Hmm. And, you know, it's just crazy that, you know, these two supposedly liberal people from the liberal state of California are, you know, against this, of just putting people on the record for what they believe in and making them talk about it.
Yeah, I think that they're both, I believe it was Jeff Merkley who identified Feinstein as one of the people who was kind of on the fence about this. This is why I say I don't think Harry Reid had 51 votes, and therefore he cut a deal with Mitch McConnell that was cosmetic enough.
You know, Tom, I was hoping, I think maybe President Obama could do something. Maybe
he has no control over the Senate.
Harry Reid.
President Obama has called for filibuster reform. He has no control over the Senate. It's a separate branch of government. You know, Joe Biden is arguably the president.
The senator from Massachusetts, he could offer him a secretary of something, so they'll resign as senators.
Yeah. We saw that played out with the John Kerry nomination. But, Chris, thank you for the call. Rusty in Jacksonville, North Carolina. Hey, Rusty, filibuster seems to be a big topic today.
Yeah, it is. I was wondering, since we can't get anything done on the filibuster, can any of the senators challenge Harry Reid for the position of majority leader?
I don't know. I believe that he has already won that election.
Yeah, I'm
quite sure that he won that election before he gaveled this new Congress into session.
Yeah, because I was wondering since his leadership has been ineffective in the last 3 years, I thought someone would want to step up and challenge him.
No, I think that there are a few like Merkley. He's this young guy who speaks out, and it plays really well in Oregon, and it plays well with the progressives, but it doesn't play well with the Democratic establishment. big D Democratic. And
yeah, it sounds like we need to.
Yeah,
we still need to step up our efforts to turn the party into become more like the ideas of Jefferson and Madison, the same way you've taught us,
or at least FDR
told us about the last couple of years.
Yeah, at least FDR. This is why, you know, we need to get involved with the Democratic Party. It's Rusty, thank you for the call. There's a certain critical mass that you reach where they can't ignore the people. And this happened inside the Republican Party when the Tea Party got involved. When right-wing Republicans got involved, they basically took over the Republican Party. And progressives, you know, sitting around complaining about the Democratic Party is not going to get us anywhere. We've got to get involved. Nori in Charleston, West Virginia. Hey, Nori, what's on your mind today?
I was calling in reference, I'm going backwards a little bit here, to the caller who was the minister drummer.
Mm-hmm.
And you were asking him where he was getting his facts.
Yeah.
And it brought to mind so much of this last election when I'd sit and listen to Ryan, especially, on the campaign trail, just flat out lying.
Yeah.
I'm from Wisconsin originally, and it just appalled me, some of the stuff he would come out with. Does nobody call these people on this stuff? I mean, is that not what the press is there for?
Well, in theory, that's what the press is there for. I mean, back before 1987, when Ronald Reagan did away with the Fairness Doctrine, the press was required to perform public service, to perform a public service in order to get their licenses renewed every year, radio and TV stations. And therefore, they carried real news, and their news departments were separate from their entertainment departments. And, you know, people were quite well informed, frankly. After he stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine, what you saw was the merger of the news departments and the entertainment departments, and we got infotainment. So, unfortunately, Nori, thank you for the call. Unfortunately, we are not seeing our news media holding people to account and being upfront. And so it kind of falls to quasi-entertainment media like this program and you know, opinion websites to share this stuff. This is interesting. I got a call here from or an email, rather, from Scott, or actually somebody here on the staff did. He said, I just heard the caller Rob talking about the cover-up in the wake of the Benghazi attack, and it was designed to take the heat off the Obama administration until after the election. And I kept asking this guy, why would it hurt Obama? And he had no answer. I mean, this is the thing. They come up with this talking point. But anyhow, the caller says there were callers to Ed Schultz this afternoon and Stephanie Miller this morning that said the exact same talking point. In fact, I think Rob was the same one who got through. Very interesting. You know, it's just, hey, they got a machine over there. You know, the Republican Party, they got the Ronald Reagan Republican building a block and a half from here. We're next door to the Heritage Foundation. They've got a machine. But I think that I kind of filleted the guy. I mean, he had nothing to say once. I was like, well, what's the advantage?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You know, what's so funny about this is that the Republicans can come up with what they say is a conspiracy theory. Everybody just salutes it, and it doesn't make any sense. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. The Tom Hartman Program. Hey, to our listeners in Los Angeles, get your tickets now for Gate 3. That's the weekend after this, Saturday, February 1st, 6:30 to 11:30. Sometime during that time period, I will be speaking at the Saban Theater. I'm assuming it's pronounced Saban Theater in Beverly Hills. For more information on that, go to gatecommunity.org. And this weekend, for our Minnesota listeners and people in nearby environs who'd like to come to Minneapolis, Minneapolis-St. Paul, the Minneapolis Hilton, 7 to 11 p.m., AM 950's Blue State Ball. Last night I was on John Fugelsang's TV program, and he was like, hey, I'll see you at the Blue State Ball. Yes! For tickets and for more information, go to am950radio.com, am950radio.com. for the Blue State Ball. And it's interesting. Saturday morning, I'm going to be getting up around 5 a.m. to head out to the airport to catch my 8 a.m. flight up to Minneapolis. And Saturday, by coincidence, is going to be the first day that we will have water on our boat. Those of you who have been following the ongoing saga, you know, we discovered that there's this really kind of cool little unknown thing here in Washington, D.C., which is the marina, and where for about one-fourth the cost of rent, if you buy a used boat, which we did, we got a 30-year-old Chris-Craft, buy a used boat, you can park it there for a whole lot less than rent. It's like cheap living. It's kind of cool. And it's also, you know, you're in the water. And we're really having a good time. Except that, well, I'm not complaining. I mean, I kind of knew this came with the territory. This thing called winter water, which means winter no water. Like when it froze here 3-4 days ago, they turned off the water to the marina. And, I mean, we do have access to winter. Actually, they turned off the water like 2 weeks ago. And I've been filling up the tank with a hose every 3 or 4 days. But then the hose froze. So we got no water in the boat. And they can't, and so, you know, can't take a shower in the boat, can't use the bathroom in the boat. And so we got to run down the dock to the security gate where they've got actually bathrooms and showers and laundry. And so this morning I got up, you know, well, this morning, yesterday morning, get up early in the morning and throw on some clothes and take a towel and a bottle of shampoo and walk down and, you know, get ready. And then last night, I mean, it's just like, you know, ongoing adventures. This morning, though, when I got up, there was an inch of snow on the dock and all over the boat and on the windshield of the boat and everything. I mean, it was like winter wonderland. And last night, this was hysterical. Like about 6 months ago, Jacob's got the audio someplace. It was the fish noises. I don't know if you know where that is or what it is. But, you know, when we first moved into this boat, every morning it must have been in the spring of this year because we moved in February or March. Every morning around 5 a.m., we'd suddenly start hearing this whack, 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 whack noise. And I was really concerned, so I called up a friend of mine who is a, you know, really very knowledgeable about living on the water and has lived for years. Here's the noise that we heard.
Recording.
That's what it sounds like in my bedroom, right? You know, whack, 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 whack. And I'm like, what? Is my boat falling apart? Is this like, you know, nails popping out of beams or something? So I called up Scott, and he says, he laughs, and he says, oh, yeah. He says, you've got exploding carbuncles. And I'm like, what? And he says, no, really. Actually, it's fish. It's like carp. And they whap, you know, they're eating the algae off the bottom of your boat, and they whack the side with their fins. So anyhow, last night, 11 o'clock, 11:30, almost midnight, Louise and I we had a long day, and we finally got into bed and turned the lights off, and everything's quiet. And I said, wait a minute. Do you hear bubbles? And she's like, yeah, I hear bubbles. I'm hearing a lot of bubbles. I mean, I should have gone out and recorded it for you, but it was like, and I was like, bubbles are not good if you're on a boat. It's coming out of the water, right? And so I ran upstairs and out the door of the bridge to the dock. And sure enough, there's all these bubbles coming up from the side of the boat, underneath the boat. And so I ran back in, or I could hear them. I mean, really loud. So I ran back in, I got a flashlight, and I went out, and there's all these bubbles. I'm like, Louise, come here and look at this. She comes out, and she looks, and oh, my God, look at the bubbles that are coming. And so I thought, this is it. The boat is sinking, right? It must have frozen at the water line, and, you know, it's a fiberglass hull, so maybe it cracked or something. And if it's sinking, I mean, look at all this air. I mean, there was just this enormous amount of bubbles coming out of the boat. And it was all in this one, maybe 4 foot long stretch along the middle of the boat. And so I thought that was where the crack must be. And so I'm like, you know, where's the valuable stuff? Where are, you know, the family pictures? What, why, emergency plan? And but there was no alarm going off. The bilge pumps weren't going. There was no, apparently. So I'm opening hatches, and Louise is trying to get a hatch open. She's pulling apart a couch to try and get into a hatch to look on, you know, underneath down below and see if there's water. You know, if it, are we taking on water? Are we filling up? Because underneath where we live and sleep is the motors. And in the midst of this, I thought, I got to call Scott and ask him what's going on, if he knows something that I don't know, you know. And so I called Scott, and I, you know, fortunately he was awake, and I said, I'm, you know, sorry to bother you at this time of the day, but, you know, I think my boat is sinking, and we're going to be dead in 20 minutes, you know, frozen Davy Jones locker. And, yeah, that's exactly what it sounded like. I mean, it was more punctuated, but, yeah. And so he says, well, it's what it is he said, at your marina, they've got this pump that blows bubbles underneath all the boats. They've got like this hose with holes punched in it that runs all the way down the finger dock. And the bubbles, basically, whenever the air temperature is below 20 degrees, they do this so that the water doesn't freeze and lock the boats in. And so the bubbles are to keep the water from freezing on the surface. He said, it's good for you. It's helping you. And I said, oh, whew, thank you. And as I got off the phone, Louise comes bursting into the bedroom, the master stateroom, I think they call it, and says, I can't get this couch up. I can't get that hatch open. I don't, you know, and I said, it's okay. It's okay. And she's like, well, what is it? And I said, well, I just talked to Scott, and he said, there's this kind of fish that when the surface of the water starts to freeze, this fish goes up to the water and grabs these giant gulps of air, like enough to fill up a whole balloon, and then goes deep down underwater to hold it, and then eventually lets it out, and those bubbles come up, and they hit the bottom of the boat. And so the fish are hiding out underneath their boat. And she looks at me kind of funny and goes, well, I guess that's okay. And I'm like, yeah, everything's fine. And then I told her the real story, and she's like, you punked me. It's the first time in years I've gotten away with something like that. Just, okay, so enough of that story. Now, yes, exactly. Gilligan's Island. I mean, that's what it's like living in our house. So anyhow, why I started this whole thing was Saturday morning. I'm going to Minneapolis, and because the weather forecast says that Saturday around 10 o'clock in the morning is when it's going to get above freezing for the very first time, and we'll be able to actually have water on the boat. And I won't be there. I'll be in Minneapolis. But Louise will be there, and so, you know, hopefully she can fill the boat. David in Woodland Hills, California. Hey, David, let's get back to the Constitution and the Second Amendment, okay?
Well, thank you for making up my mind. I'm never living on a boat.
I'll tell you, it is a very unique experience. It really
okay.
is.
I called yesterday, and I had to hang up before you could get to me because I had to go to work. This is about the Second Amendment shall not be infringed. I looked that up in the dictionary, and it means to fail to observe the terms of. Part of the terms of the Second Amendment is a well-regulated militia.
Yes.
By failing to observe those terms, it is the NRA who infringes the Second Amendment.
I agree. And where the Supreme Court found an individual right, albeit a moderated right, you know, it's not an absolute right, just like our free speech is not an absolute right. But where the NRA found an individual right to own firearms in the Second Amendment, I don't know, because it starts out a well-regulated militia being essential to the security of a free state. And by the way, they said state instead of country, because the slave states had their slave patrols, also known as their militias. But that's a whole other story. David, I'm with you. Thank you very much. Liz in North Aurora, Illinois. Hey, Liz, got a minute to the break. It's all yours.
Okay, hold on.
I'm listening.
I don't get why everyone is so organized about gerrymandering. Why? I mean, if both red states and blue states are involved, why can't they share some of it? Some fair vote.
I share your concern, and I think that I'm guessing that what is triggering your upset is what's going on in Virginia right now, where they're ramming through a gerrymandering of the state senate districts, and today for the second day in a row, the Republicans in the Virginia House did not take up that legislation. So it's like a little powder keg there, and on top of that, now they're trying to rig the Electoral College in Virginia. So vote rigging is a fire in Virginia. And, you know, I think that this should wake us all up to the fact that gerrymandering, whether it's done by Democrats or Republicans, vote rigging, whether it's done by Democrats or Republicans, and, you know, generally these days it seems it's done by Republicans. Voter suppression, certainly a Republican tactic, is wrong. And we need a nonpartisan commission to oversee our elections, which I think the president was calling for.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Remember in his inaugural address, he said, you know, we got to fix this thing of people standing in line for hours and hours. It's another one of the Republican strategies. I'm with him. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, is on the line with us. Hey, Bob, welcome back.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am fine, although we are on winter water. Now, you used to live on a boat that's right, in fact, your old boat is right opposite ours in the very same marina.
Right.
And your houseboat. You remember winter water?
Oh, I do. Yes, I do.
Running up to the guardhouse to take a shower in the morning?
I surely do.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Bucket bath, sort of India style.
Yes, yes. By the way, quick question, Bob. Shane and I were trying to, Shane was trying to explain to me, and I was trying to explain to a listener what filling the tree is, filling the amendment tree. With regard to the Senate and the filibuster and stuff like that.
The amendment tree.
Yeah, now you were in the House of Representatives. Yes. Maybe this is a more arcane Senate
the
thing.
Amendment tree. I mean, we used to call the Senate or the president was the opposition, the Senate was the enemy. So we didn't use the term.
Okay. All right, so this is a uniquely senatorial phrase, apparently. So what's going on in the world, Bob?
Well, the filibuster, you know, the Senate leaders have agreed to a great big deal to reform filibusters that doesn't reform filibusters.
Yep.
But they've agreed on something.
Now, was this the result of Harry Reid not having 51 votes? In other words, 8 or 9 Democratic senators didn't have his back on making these changes that, you know, 3 months ago he said, you know, Senator Merkley has called for these changes and he is right and I was wrong. Or is this the result of Harry Reid himself deciding that this wasn't such a good idea and going against the will of 51 Democratic senators?
I don't think he's got the votes at the end of the day, because look, people are looking to when Harry Reid leaves.
Yeah.
And like anything, the party in power, when they're not in power, want to, you know, they want to have this, and then the party in power doesn't, you know, and they have the, I think, insane closure rule. That thing's not getting changed anywhere quick.
Right.
So I think the others that maybe were waiting for when the day Reid leaves, they don't like it.
When Reid leaves, who would be behind him? Would it be Dick Durbin?
I would, if I had to put money, it would be Dick Durbin. With Dick Durbin's operating style, and I don't mean that bad. He's you know, aggressive, but he knows the system there. He knows how to play the game.
Yeah, him or Chuck Schumer? I mean, they're both very, very competent legislators.
Oh, that would be one heck of a fight.
Yeah.
Schumer versus Durbin.
Yeah. And, well, Schumer as House Majority Leader would be one hell of a thing. Anyhow, okay. So the filibuster didn't get blown up. It just kind of got whispered on. What else is going on?
Well, the big issue is Senator Feinstein, and she introduced the bill. And I have to tell you, right off the bat, again, Reid will have a problem with this. And it's a specific, you know, it's going to be Senator Manchin near my home state of Ohio, of West
Virginia.
Democrat
from West Virginia.
Yes, the Senator from Alaska, Begich. And mm-hmm. You're going to also have Max Baucus of Montana. And I just have to throw Al Franken's name out there. I'm not saying that he's for sure, you know, against this, but Al Franken and also the senator from New Hampshire, Gene Shaheen, may have some heartburn over this.
Yeah.
So if 12 Democratic senators have a problem, there is a problem.
Yeah.
With this. It's the assault ban. It goes back to the old assault ban. In fact, it's more lenient in the amount of sporting rifles that can still be used and not on the ban list. Last time it was 357 on the ban list. This time that were, you know, grandfathered and were okay, and now it's 2,000 some. So she actually has more leniency on that issue.
Wow. But still, it probably won't pass. And isn't today like the 35th anniversary of George Moscone and Harvey Milk getting murdered?
That's right. And, of course, Senator Feinstein was out there.
She was standing there. She was on the city council at that time.
That's right. And that was the 30th-some anniversary of it. That's correct. Yeah. But that was the big news today. She's introduced the bill. And, again, it'll have some hard sledding. Senator Kerry, it was kumbaya. Hillary Clinton yesterday took the hits, although I've got to tell you, I mean, the ineptness. John McCain and you know what Hillary Clinton had for lunch yesterday? Senator McCain and the Republican members of the House.
Yeah, that's and Ron Johnson.
Lunch.
And then today, Ron Johnson goes after John Kerry saying, well, why didn't we know what was going on in Benghazi? And John Kerry says, well, you know, when we had that that closed door hearing where the intelligence community came in and showed us the videotapes minute by minute, hour by hour of everything that went on. Well, you were in that meeting, weren't you, Senator? And Ron Johnson says, no, I didn't. Show up.
He also backed down on what he said about Hillary being emotional. He backed down a couple of hours ago on that one.
Yeah. Maybe and I shouldn't have projected or guessed or whatever the word was. Yeah.
They were ill prepared. They do what has been done for years on investigatory committees of the House and the Senate. And they just blew any chance of legitimate questioning, frankly.
Yeah.
So Kerry's was kumbaya today, of course, and he also supported Hegel, which is a great nod.
Yeah, it is. I'm curious what your take is on this conspiracy theory that Rand Paul has floated, that's flying around the right wing blogosphere, that we did in fact take some of the armories of weapons in Libya and take them out of the country. And that makes sense, actually. But that what's going on is that we are systematically disarming Libya and selling those weapons to Turkey to you know, get some cash to, I don't know, buy cocaine or something. I'm thinking of Iran-Contra. But,
exactly.
That we're disarming Libya as a dress rehearsal for disarming America.
And that's just—it's just not happening.
Rand Paul laid this out last night on Sean Hannity's show, without the part about it's a dress rehearsal for America. But everybody who had read the right-wing websites knew what he was talking about.
No, it's just—I just can't imagine whatsoever that we're doing that. We've done some lousy things in the past, but I can't imagine.
Yeah, no, it's hallucinatory. But it's like this kind of thing is grabbing hold on the right. And is Rand Paul going to be viewed as a crackpot, do you think? Or is he by his own caucus?
I think Rand Paul, if he continues, you know, with this type of thing, will be the Santorum of the next election.
Yeah.
And, you know, Santorum, everybody says, oh, he's so much better than Romney, but he couldn't even get through a Republican primary. He was so out there.
Well, again, he couldn't hold on to his own state.
Yes, he just couldn't. And I think Rand Paul, who, you know, had some decent standing amongst groups, if he gets into these, you know, 9-1-1 wasn't Osama bin Laden type of things that you've seen people do, then he's going to blow his chance.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Well, I've got a voice in my ear, Shane. Are we out of time or are we not? We are. Okay. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Bob, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Good talking with you. We'll be back 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, there's only one way to stop the GOP from rigging the vote. I'm going to share that with you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with me. I've got Shano gave me a printout of Filling the Tree, the Wikipedia page on the Filling the Amendment Tree. Basically, the Senate Majority Leader can just kind of stuff it full of stuff. And so, anyway, it's, you know, fill up all the amendments before the other party gets a chance to get in there. So we've got that. Ryan on line 5 says he knows the answer to why Benghazi didn't come out before the election. I want to get to that. But first, I just have to share this with you. In the beginning, there were big states and little states. Virginia and Delaware, Pennsylvania and Rhode Island, Georgia and New Hampshire. The little states wanted to make sure that their voices weren't drowned out by the big states, that they couldn't be marginalized or pushed out of the way altogether, and that they could see themselves as equal parts of the American government. So the framers of the Constitution put together protections for the small states in that document, in the Constitution, giving them a little bit more on a per capita basis than the big states. It was good to be a small state citizen. Still is, by the way. 600,000 people in the state of Vermont And they have two senators and one representative, three people representing them in Congress. That's a whole lot, and the same thing in Wyoming. That's a whole lot more than a Californian. You know, you got, what, 30 million people in California, I think? Close to that. It's some incredible number of people. And they have two senators. So anyhow, one of these two ways that the kind of compromise that was necessary to get the small states like Delaware and Rhode Island to say, yes, we will join the big states like Pennsylvania and Massachusetts and be part of the union. One was that even if a state was so small that they only had one representative in the House of Representatives, as Wyoming is right now, Vermont is right now, they would still get two full senators. And the second was that each small state would also get an additional two votes, which is represented by those senators, in the Electoral College. For most of our nation's history, the minority never abused these privileges, though we have recently seen a series of abuses of the Senate filibuster by the Republicans. But the Electoral College wasn't created just to protect the minority. This is where it gets really interesting. It was also there, just like the Second Amendment. I mean, the first purpose of the Second Amendment was to block the possibility of America ever having a standing army. Good luck on that, right? But the second purpose of the Second Amendment was to protect the institution of slavery in the southern states. And that was also this big state, little state thing. The political problem the slave states were facing when the Constitution was written was that there were very few white males, the legal voters of the day, living in many of those slave states, especially as you got farther and farther south, down into South Carolina and Georgia. There were a lot of slaves, but they weren't allowed to vote. Not so many white males. Which is why they had their slave patrols. So if the president was elected by a national popular vote, which is what James Madison originally argued for when the Constitution was being put together, the slave states would not be contributing that many states to who, or that many votes to who becomes president of the United States. And the southern slave owners lived in constant fear, not only of their own slaves, but also that some northerner president might try to undo slavery, sort of like Abraham Lincoln actually did, you know. So the slave states and the small states, the compromise for them was the Electoral College. So you get extra votes. They would have lacked if it was just a national popular vote, which brings us to today. Now that the Republican Party has been hijacked by the billionaire class, a very small 1% sliver of our population, they've taken huge, unprecedented steps to abuse the Electoral College. In the first, the starting point for this actually would be Bush v. Gore. But in the first election since Citizens United, hundreds of millions of dollars in outside spending from, you know, genuine American oligarchs like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson put the Republicans in control of traditionally blue states, the ones that they had targeted back after Bush v. Gore. And I thought Shano's observation the other day that, hey, in Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court came right out and said, people of the United States do not have a right, a constitutional right, to vote for president of the United States. Ooh, they don't have the right. Well, then let's rig the game. So Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, they're on it. So what'd they do? They spent, the oligarchs started spending a lot of money at the state level to put Republicans in charge of the state legislatures and the governor's office. And once they got that, with the census of 2000 and the census of 2010, mostly census of 2010, the Republicans gerrymandered the congressional districts to increase the number of safe Republican seats and fracture the Democratic seats. And that's one reason why the House Democratic candidates got more than a million votes, 1.5 million votes than the House Republican candidates around the nation last November, but the Republicans still run the House of Representatives because of gerrymandering. And Republicans are now using these gerrymandered states to push this breathtaking thing in Virginia. They're trying to rig the 2016 presidential election here now in 2013. Instead of a winner-take-all system, Republicans want Virginia's Electoral College votes doled out based on which presidential candidate won each congressional district, with an extra two votes going to that state's popular vote winner. It's kind of like, well, let's throw the dog a bone. You know, we'll make it seem like it's sort of. Republicans in Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, they're all considering similar changes. And RNC Chair Rince Priebus has thrown his support behind the idea. So how big of an advantage will the Republicans have? Consider this. President Obama swept the six main battleground states of Florida, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin last election. All six states, all Republican governors, he won every single one of them. Since it's a winner-take-all system, the president got 106 electoral college votes. Romney got zero because he beat him in every one of those states. I'm talking about just out of those six states. But if this new scheme had been in place before the last election, then the president would have only gotten 47 electoral college votes, while Mitt Romney would have gotten 59, even though he lost the popular vote in every single state. And had all the states in the nation made those changes, today we would have been, you know, we'd be on the back end of the week in which President Mitt Romney gave an inaugural address, even though he lost the national vote by millions, just like George Bush did in 2000. He lost the national vote by about a half a million. Billionaires and the Republicans they own know that they're a minority in America. Their hard-right bigotry toward gays and women turns off young voters. Their xenophobia, mistrust of non-whites, have turned off a growing minority electorate. Reaganomics has been exposed as a scam. So today, the majority of us have to do something before the billionaires take over completely. So what is it? We need to scrap the Electoral College altogether. I mean, that's it. It should be replaced with more democracy, a national popular vote model that elects our president based on which candidate gets the most votes nationwide, plain and simple. Nine states have already passed national popular vote laws, so their electors will vote for whichever candidate wins a national popular vote once enough states have done so that 270 votes are counted for. California, Maryland, Illinois, a bunch of states, nine states have done this. So we need to get involved in this national popular vote thing. So if this trend continues and enough states sign up to bring their combined Electoral College vote to 270, the Electoral College will basically die. You don't even have to amend the Constitution. It just dies. Now, the Republicans are working on an Electoral College strategy for 2016. Democrats, progressives, independents should be two. And it should be whoever gets the most votes for president is president. It's pretty simple.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, the Republicans are going to do everything they can to make sure that that's not the case. But national popular vote, go check it out. Stick it into the DuckDuckGo machine. Okay, welcome back. Ryan, thank you for waiting on hold so long in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. You apparently know the answer to why the president would order the Secretary of State to order Susan Rice to lie about what happened in Benghazi for political purposes. Do I have that right?
Well, I don't have. Kind of.
Okay.
I'm kind of backtracking, and I'm kind of backtracking here. But at 4:30, you mentioned a caller or writer named Rob about him not having a reason why Benghazi would hurt Obama before the election?
Well, he couldn't explain it to me. Yeah. So I'm asking you to. You think that okay. You can?
I think I have an answer.
Okay. I'm listening.
It would sway for anybody who, like, Mr. Obama has a persona for keeping the peace in the world, you know, making it a peaceful place. Which
he does?
Is fantastic. But I don't.
Wait a minute. He doesn't.
Yes.
That's Ryan. That's yes. Nonsense. Yes. President Obama surged the troops in Afghanistan. President Obama was at that point continuing, I guess he was winding down the war in Iraq, but, I mean, he was doing drone strikes in three different countries, for goodness sake. Nobody thinks of this guy as a pacifist. If anything, he's one of the more aggressive presidents we've had in the last couple of decades.
Yes, but there are some undecided voters that maybe would have said, hey, you know, his foreign policy isn't too sound, and that's why they made a, you know, they might have lost their vote. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying I have an answer. I have no idea.
I don't understand. Why would somebody say, I'm not going to vote for President Obama because terrorists killed our ambassador instead of because a crowd, a protester killed the ambassador? Why would anybody vote for or against?
I can't speak for them. I'm just throwing out.
So you don't know the answer?
I don't know the answer. Okay. I'm just throwing out again.
Okay.
That's all.
Yeah, because I mean, it's like the Republicans are speaking, and Fox News and all these guys on the right, they're like, this is an absolute article of faith. Ron Johnson, there's been a cover up of Benghazi, and Susan Rice was involved in this. Now Hillary Clinton's involved in it, and apparently, if Ron Johnson had shown up at the hearing that John Kerry attended, where they actually laid all this stuff out, which was apparently a month or two ago. He would have all the details, including all the top secret details, and he wouldn't be asking stupid questions. But I haven't been able to figure out what they were covering up. I mean, they didn't. Susan Rice was using the talking points that the CIA provided her, saying that it looked like there was a protest that had gone wrong. Whether they knew that that was true or not, I think that there's a – frankly, here's my theory. And, Ryan, reality check this with me. If I'm the CIA and I know that there's a terrorist cell operating outside of Benghazi that is affiliated with al-Qaeda and they went in and they killed our ambassador and we're 4 days out, right? The ambassador's been dead for 4 days and I'm the terrorist, I'm the CIA, excuse me, and I know that there's a terrorist cell that killed this guy and I'm trying to figure out how to take out these terrorists. Are we going to go in with drones? Are we going to go in with soldiers? Are we going to use the local forces? How are we going to take these people out? The last thing on earth, if I'm the CIA, that I would want to do is go on national television and say, yeah, just 20 miles up the road, there's a bunch of terrorists. Because the first thing that they would do when they watch that on CNN is say, holy cow, I am out of town. Feet, do your thing. And they'd be in another country by the time we showed up. So if I was the CIA, I would be saying to Susan Rice, please go out and tell the American people that it was protesters because, whether they actually told her it was terrorists or not doesn't matter in my mind, because I think that they're, in fact, John Kerry in the hearing today said they are very close to actually bringing these people to justice. And until these guys are nailed, I think the last thing that our intelligence service should be doing is talking on CNN about who they are and where they are. Does that make sense to you, Ryan?
No, that makes perfect sense. I do have one more question, and
okay.
Brought it up as a quick segment about women and serving in the front line.
Yeah.
I'm all for equality. I think it's fantastic. It's what America is built upon. I think that's a bad idea.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that the rationale that is the most commonly used one that guys are going to be embarrassed to take a whiz in front of a lady is
no.
Okay. What's your thinking? Because the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff today said that he thinks that having women serve with men in the front lines in combat, if we look at the experience of countries where they have done that and they actually have front lines and they actually have combat like Israel, is that the men have stopped the sexual assaults on women. That it has improved the overall culture and the nature of the relationship between the two genders. And he said that the same thing happened when women were admitted to West Point. Sexual assaults went down. Male piggishness went down, and the place became a more civil place. And why would that not happen in combat? Why would the Israelis have that experience? And we wouldn't.
Well, I think even prior to them even serving in a combat zone, they have to go through training.
Sure. Correct? Just like the men.
So I went to the military. I was in the Marine Reserves back in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to undergo, extensive training. And if I didn't pass, I wasn't allowed to serve. I did pass.
Sure. Well, that's going to be the case with women too. They're you're not going to see some 70-pound, 5'1" man or woman on the front lines. You're going to see somebody who can carry a 50-pound pack and pull an AR-15 or whatever the weapon of choice is these days.
Absolutely. But do you think that maybe further down the road there a woman that maybe is rejected, that, hey, you didn't pass physical exams, could maybe, like, go to someone and say, hey, you know, this isn't right, and they would have to lower that bar? And don't you think that would...
No. No, no, they, Ryan, you know, the bar that you had to jump over, to extend that metaphor, to get successfully into the Marine Corps Reserves has probably been there for 50 years. You know, they haven't raised or lowered it because of men. I don't see that happening. I mean, it hasn't happened historically. Ryan, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So we're still left with this question, the Republican conspiracy theory. Ron Johnson and Paul Ryan, their conspiracy theory is that Obama's trying to cover up Benghazi. And the very, very predatoriously ugly, the good. Ireland. Irish and other United Kingdom government officials signed an agreement today to build some of the world's largest wind turbines on the Emerald Isle. The turbines, which will be more than 600 feet tall, will be able to generate enough energy for millions of UK homes by 2017. That's interesting. Ireland is not part of the UK. In any case, the UK is already one of the biggest wind energy producers in the world, and wind turbines dotting the UK countryside and many in the North Sea. The UK realizes, and Ireland realizes, that wind is a clean and green form of energy. Too bad Washington doesn't feel the same way. The bad. Senator Kay Hagan. While the UK is pushing for wind energy, Hagan, a Democrat from North Carolina, is urging President Obama to approve construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, arguing that it will create jobs and provide energy security. First, the jobs that the pipeline would create will only be temporary. Second, the majority of the oil from the pipeline will be exported, although we get the soot and the crud from the refining. And finally, building the pipeline means continuing this nation's toxic addiction to the fossil fuels that are destroying our environment and causing climate change. Senator Hagan should be pushing to create jobs in the clean energy industry instead. And the very, very ugly Senator Ron Johnson. Johnson was one of the Republican senators who attacked Secretary of State Hillary Clinton yesterday during her testimony on the Benghazi terror attacks. Questioning got so heated that Clinton responded rather emotionally. After the hearing, Johnson told multiple news outlets that Clinton faked the emotional outburst in order to avoid the questions. But Johnson wasn't the only one going after Hillary. The New York Post, owned by Rupert Murdoch, printed a cover saying, "No wonder Bill's afraid of Hillary," referring to the same show of emotion. It's clear that Republicans and the conservative media are unleashing sexist attacks on Clinton in order to score political points, and that is very, very ugly. Is Ireland part of the United Kingdom? I don't think so anymore. I don't. Maybe, maybe not. Somebody should call Andrew and find out. Anyhow, welcome back. Joe in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Long-time listener. Love your show.
Thank
hey, you just talk about gerrymandering and redistricting. You know, I think it's apparent that the Republicans can't win from the top down, so they're trying to break things from the bottom up. Here in Marion County in Indianapolis, a state legislator has proposed that the city county council eliminate 4 at-large seats, which are currently held all by Democrats, and give the mayor more control over the city county council. Simultaneously, there's a bill that's been introduced in Indiana regarding the State Board of Education that would remove the requirement that the state board is balanced on a partisan basis and would equally give the governor more power to appoint folks to sit on that board and remove the requirement that those folks, in fact, be licensed teachers and licensed educators. So this stuff is happening from the ground up as well at the community level, the school board level, the city county council level. Republicans cannot win from the top down. They have no good candidates at the national level, so they're breaking things from the bottom up.
Well, or an easier way to say it would be they can't win the game, so they're going to rig the game.
Oh, absolutely. They're changing the rules to their favor, and it's happening. You know, again, I think that we're seeing the big things in Virginia and Pennsylvania and Ohio and so forth. those things are pretty high profile on a national right. level. But even at the
but it's happening level yeah, here, at the level of the dog catcher. Yeah, I'm with you, Joe. And by the way, that's the level at which, if you want to change things, you need to get involved in local Democratic Party politics and you know, show up. Eric, in Winnetka, California?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Just great. What's up?
So I wanted to talk to you about Compact for America real quick.
Okay.
You know, the July 4th proposition where the GOP is going to use Article 5 of the Constitution to amend the balanced budget.
Ah, yes.
Go ahead.
No, the Compact for America drew a blank for a moment, but now I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the organization that's surrounding it. But one thing I wanted to ask regarding your topic today is, you know, if this is something that they can do where we can't do anything about it to prevent it, what's stopping, and they use this shortcut to add stuff to the Constitution, what's stopping them from changing how elections are done in general moving forward?
Not a lot. I mean, the Republicans are like I said, you know, they can't win an election, so they're trying to rig the game. They're going to try to amend the Constitution. There's a whole variety of things that they're up to. And basically, it's like, you know, the billionaires behind them are pulling the strings and making these things happen. They got all this money. They are a very tiny minority in the United States. This is how they acquire and hang on to power. Ken in Albuquerque, listening on 1350 AM. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Yeah, hi. United Kingdom is Scotland and England.
Yeah, I didn't think it was Ireland.
Yeah, and the flag actually combines the Scotch flag with the English flag, which is where you get that unique design. I love it when these Christian nation proponents start hauling out all these quotes by all the founding fathers and all of this vast library that they have, because every quote reinforces my assertion, which is that the founding fathers put aside all of that stuff. They just set it off to the side, and they created for us a secular, godless constitution.
Yes. The word God is not in the Constitution. And in fact, you cannot use religion as a test for qualification for political office.
So it doesn't matter how many quotes they bring up. In fact, the more quotes they bring up, the better, because the founders still pushed all that away to create the Constitution that we have now.
Yeah, totally with you, Ken. Thank you very much for calling. Well said. Debbie in Weston, Colorado. Hey, Debbie. You have a Benghazi theory?
I do. To me, it seems obvious that that the Republicans are just making up things, because what they really don't want to happen is for Hillary Clinton to run for president again,
mm-hmm.
or if she does, that she should win.
Yeah, yeah. I am personally of the opinion that she probably won't, but I have been surprised many times in the past. I think that she's at a point in her life where she's looking forward to retiring, But who knows? I mean, 4 years from now, after a couple of years off and a couple of tours around the country, she might be super duper energized. The question then is going to be, is Joe Biden going to run? And he's 70 years old right now, so he'll be 74 then. But on the other hand, Ronald Reagan was older than that when he ran. So.
Yeah, well, just the other day on C-SPAN, I was listening to some of the new new women who have won office. Some were Republican, some were Democrat. At any rate, the Republicans were all excited. They women were really talking about Hillary running. So I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. We'll see. As the great philosopher Mike Dirks used to say about pretty much everything, we'll see. Debbie, thank you for the call. Clyde in Glenville, North Carolina. Hey, Clyde, the nuclear option is the Republicans?
Well, you were talking about the filibuster rule.
Mm-hmm.
You're old enough. You remember when Bill Frist was running the Senate. Anytime they had an unsavory piece of legislation that they wanted to sneak past without a 60-man majority, they just attach it to a budget bill, and boom.
Yep.
No filibuster.
Get it through
like they're doing in Virginia.
Say it louder.
All them other places.
Oh, reconciliation. Right. Thank you. I knew it started with an R.
Exactly.
I was up last night chasing bubbles in the middle of the night, and got up this morning at 6:30, 7 o'clock to run, you know, half naked down the dock to jump in the shower, and I didn't get enough sleep last night. My brain isn't working well, Clyde. Yes, you're absolutely right.
One more thing.
Yeah.
You were talking about women in the military, mm-hmm. and I haven't heard anybody mention it yet, but I'll bet you once they are in forward positions, civilian death rates will drop tremendously.
I'll bet you're right.
Think about it.
I'll bet you're absolutely right. Clyde, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Brian in Chicago. Hey, Brian, what's up? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
I just had a call. I'm usually not all political, but I just had to call you because you keep ripping on the Republicans about gerrymandering their states and their districts, correct? Since I've been listening, I mean, you've mm-hmm. been ripping on them, right?
Yeah, well,
why don't you mention Illinois?
The Democrats do it too. Brian, I'll give you that. The thing that I'm concerned about is not that the Republicans gerrymandered. It's that this plan was put together after Bush v. Gore, when it was decided, you know, when the Supreme Court said that you and I, Brian, do not have a constitutional right to vote for President of the United States. So the billionaires got together, the American Legislative Exchange Council, this group funded by the Koch brothers and all these guys, these think tanks, they got together and said, how can we rig the presidential election so that a Republican is president even if he loses the national popular vote?
Well, I completely agree with you on that. The simple way is
you have to get control of five or six swing states that traditionally go Democratic for the president, but there's, you know, they're kind of in between for, you know, locally. Get control of the state Senate, the state House of Representatives, and the governor's office, and then in those states, change the way they apportion their electoral votes. And that's what they have been methodically doing. This is the Scott Walker, Rick Snyder, Tom Corbett. You know, this is what it's all. This is the end game. We are seeing the end game now. And gerrymandering was the first piece of it, but it's of a whole. But you're absolutely right, Brian. Yeah, both parties have been gerrymandering forever, and I think both parties should be banned from doing it. I think that it's, you know, we should. But polygons, that's the magic word, right? Every congressional district should have, you know, sides that are all equal. We'll be back. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Say what?
Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Indeed. And TomHartman.com, you can also drop into our live chat room and hang out with some of the finest minds on earth. Welcome back. It's Thursday. Let's get geeky. Ever wonder why your dog will inhale just about any type of food you feed it, or why it likes human food so much it's going to jump up on the kitchen table to get it? Well, as it turns out, a dog's willingness, ability, whatever, to eat traditionally human foods instead of biting your arm off helps to explain how its ancestors evolved from wild wolves to domesticated pups. A group of researchers in Sweden compared the genes of wolves and dogs and found that a big difference between the two is dogs' ability to easily digest starch. At some point during the transition from wild carnivores, wolves, to cute and cuddly snuggle lovers, dogs learned to want, or at least to live off of, typical staples in the human diet, like wheat, rice, barley, corn, and potatoes. And this kind of transition from meat lover to grain lover also occurred in the history of humans. We call it the agricultural revolution. He emerged from the wild, invented agriculture, settled into diets that were rich in grains, which doesn't work so well for some of us like me with celiac disease. Eric Axelson, one of the researchers on the study and a geneticist at Sweden's Uppsala University, I've been there, told the Washington Post that, quote, I think it's a striking case of coevolution. The fact that we shared a similar environment in the last 10,000 years caused a similar adaptation. And the big change in the environment was the development of agriculture. Axelson's findings, published in the journal Nature, support the often argued hypothesis that dogs evolved from wolves who found new sources of food in the trash of the outskirts of human settlements. And after a while of eating human food, the wolves began to tolerate our food and also us. And then we brought them into our households for protection and for work and companionship. And now human-tolerant and possibly fully domesticated canids, ancestors of today's domesticated dogs, may have existed as many as 33,000 years ago, and archaeological remains show dogs and humans sharing the same graves 11,000 years ago, which corresponds with the dawn of agriculture. So the next logical question is that if dogs domesticated themselves or adapted over time, did humans have a role in the process. The evidence of natural selection in the amount and efficiency of key digestive enzymes in dogs supports the notion that dogs may have done it themselves, just to be able to eat our garbage. Essentially, under the theory of natural selection, dogs were selected to scavenge off the food scraps of humans. So along with the changes in diet in the transition from wild wolves to domesticated dogs, also changes in behavior, let dogs be more comfortable living near us, become pets. Swedish researchers found evidence of genetic differences in brain function and development between wolves and domesticated dogs. So the next time you give Fido a doggy biscuit filled with wheat and rice, be grateful that that little pup is munching on that and not your hand. Right. Ron in Susquehanna, Washington. Hey, Ron. Northern Ireland is part of the UK, but Ireland is not. That was my recollection. Is that what you have to say?
Yeah, that's basically what I had to say. It was United Kingdom refers to the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland.
And Wales was part of it, too, was it not?
And that's part of Great Britain. Great Britain is Scotland, Wales, and England.
Scotland, Wales, and England, but not Northern Ireland.
But not Northern Ireland. So then the United Kingdom is the whole group, all four of them.
So Great Britain and United Kingdom mean two different things.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll bet Sue in our chat room has already told me this, and I just haven't had a moment to read it. Cool.
Yeah, the official name is United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, commonly known as the United Kingdom.
You're right. Okay. Cool. But none of it includes Ireland, so the southern part of Ireland.
No, they must have had a different name back when England was still, when Britain was still ruling Ireland.
Yeah, yeah. I was over there during the Troubles back in the late 70s, early 80s. Louise and I were driving around Northern Ireland, around Belfast, and a truck with a machine gun on the back, a half-track, pulled up behind us and started chasing us. It was absolutely bizarre. Chased us out of a neighborhood. Anyhow, Ron, thank you very much for the call. Helmer in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Helmer, what's up?
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
You're right about having extremely sharp viewers. You've already worked out the United Kingdom question. I have a concern, and it's just one that keeps coming up to me every time I listen to your program. And that is that there's nothing we can do about this gerrymandering that the Republicans are doing in states that would normally go blue. And the result is that I don't see how, if we can't do anything about it, how can we get a Democrat elected in 2016?
Right. If the Republicans are successful with this in five or six states, you know, what they're doing is they're racing ahead of demographic changes in America. And assuming that the Republican Party doesn't change its policy positions and that they're still the party of, you know, making fun of women and bashing gays and all this kind of stuff and, you know, anti-immigrant and whatnot, they're going to have a real problem in 4 years demographically. And I think they're making that up by rigging the elections. And if the election of today were done under the new rules with four or five, six states rigged like this in with regard to the Electoral College, they would win. But it may well be that 4 years from now, the American people will be so much more figured out, you know, what the Republicans are all about, that even by rigging the elections, they can't win. I mean, just like in this last election and in the election before it, they rigged the elections. I mean, there were hundreds of thousands, millions, actually, of Americans who showed up to vote and whose votes never got counted because of Republicans challenging the vote. There were millions of Americans who wanted to vote, who couldn't vote, because of the, you know, Republican voter suppression ID laws and things like that. A lot of people, you know, warned off, hey, look out, voting can be a felony if you don't, you know. I mean, all these efforts to rig the vote didn't work because the American people, with regard to the issues and the demographic, but it's not entirely demographic. I think it's issue-based as well, the whole next generation thing. Got, you know, grew faster or are moving faster than the Republicans' ability to rig elections. And I have a pretty strong feeling that that's what the case is going to be in 4 years. But we'll see. Hopefully we'll all be here to talk about it. Tomorrow, it's Friday, and that means it's Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders will be here talking about the issues of the day, plus anything goes on Town Hall Friday. What do you want to talk about? And the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. It's not a spectator sport. You got to show up. Get out there. Occupy something. Occupy the Democratic Party. Tag your head. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.